accession number 4617, reel number 5.
Mr. Armand, reel 5. So what were your first impressions of Basra when you arrived?
We stopped at Kuwait overnight, and then the next morning, in the early dawn, we moved up to the Shatt al-Arab. In my mind, I thought that Basra was a base on a desert sand with the two rivers coming in from either side, the Tigris and the Euphrates. But of course, in the event, that was quite wrong. The Tigris and the Euphrates join at Kurna, which is about 5 miles above Basra, and Basra is 80 miles up the Shatt al-Arab from the sea. So we sailed up the Shatt al-Arab, and there was a strong, overwhelming smell of oil from Abadan, which was on the port side, starboard side, I beg your pardon, starboard side going up, and there were the palm trees on both sides and the little boats, and you could see mysterious figures of the women going about the business with the black gowns all over them. And we sailed right up past the city of Basra itself, and then we came along to the RAF camp at Basra, and there was the RAF ensign flying over the headquarters there, and the long war memorial from the First World War. There was a great number, it's a very big war memorial, because it recorded all the names of the people who died in Mesopotamia in the First World War. These were mostly people who died of disease rather than enemy action. And there was a flying boat on a slipway. I didn't know at that time whether I was going to that base, because we weren't told. All we were told was that we were going to Iraq. And it could have been any one of four stations: Basra, Shaiba, Hunedi, or Mosul. And so we didn't really know at the time. And the Lancashire event moored up at Ashar, which is a small wharf just past the RAF camp. And then we were told where we were going. So the men who were going to Hunedi and Mosul, they were all taken off and went on trains for the journey up there. The people who were going to Shaiba, they went by transport. Shaiba is about 14 miles out in the desert. Then I found out that I was going to Basra, because I was very happy about that. And we had just a short journey, about 2 miles, I suppose it would be, to the RAF camp at Basra. And this was just a small camp of about 100 men altogether, all contained within a barbed wire encampment. I thought that when I got there that I should be going on to the flying again because of my past experience. But I found that I was a junior boy. This was one of the things that happens throughout my service career, that on moving on to a new station, one had to assert oneself by one's experience to gain, unless you held a rank, but I'm talking of as an airman, without any rank. And I found that when I got there that I was a junior boy, and that the there was no place for me on an air crew. Also, of course, at that time, there was no additional pay for going abroad. And in fact, I'd lost 10 and sixpence a week. I'd lost my flying pay and I'd lost my air gunner's pay. And so I was 10 and sixpence a week worse off than I was at home. I couldn't get into the flight to fly, so at the time, my flight commander said I should have to go into the workshop. And I and another lad went into the workshop, and when we got there, we were the only two aircraft tradesmen, and in the corner was a Tiger Moth, which had been some erstwhile record player breaker trying to fly to Australia, and he'd crashed in the desert, run out of fuel. And this Tiger Moth was brought in and was just dumped in the corner, all broken plywood and so on. So my first 6 months at Basel was spent in rebuilding this Tiger Moth. I enjoyed it, but largely we were unsupervised. An NCO would come across occasionally as we reached each stage of building, and he would put his signature after my own, and then he would go and leave us again.
Did it eventually fly again?
Oh yes, it flew, yes, but before it flew, we had gone away. About this was 1934 when I got there, and I spent the winter in this workshop. By the spring, I'd moved into the flights then, because the various people had left. You know, it was a 2-year station, and each one of us did 2 years there, and then we were posted elsewhere. It was a 5-year tour of a service abroad. And so we did 2 years there, which was called a bad station, and then 3 years somewhere else, either in Egypt or India or Malta. So by the April, I'd moved on to the flight line then, and I found that although I didn't have my own aircraft, I was working on the boats and assisting in preparation for cruises.
Why was Basra called a bad station?
Hot weather, hot country. You see, the temperatures in the summer were anything 120 in the shade and above. And after one season, everyone suffered in prickly heat, and it was, you know, your affected your health very much. In the second year, I usually managed to let everyone go through up into the hills for a short break to recuperate. It was a long, very long summer, very hot, and of course there were no modern facilities there, air conditioning, no such thing as air conditioning. Your accommodation was a long low building with fans which ticked away on low voltage electricity and just stirred the heat a little, but there was no relief from it. And what we used to find was that it was preferable to sleep on the roof of the building rather than sleep inside, where at least the air was became a little cooler towards the dawn, you know, in the early hours of morning. It did cool down a bit, whereas it didn't cool at all inside the room, inside the billets. And we used to hear the bullfrogs croaking away, but that was preferable to being inside. So it was a bad station, you see. Never saw any other white people at all. I never saw a white female there in the whole time I was there, other than two nurses. We outside of the camp in some old buildings which were about 3 miles out in the desert. There was a sick quarters, a hospital building, and there were two sisters there, two RAF nursing sisters, and a doctor there, and he used to take in mostly malarial cases there. where they were wanted a little more treatment that could be given in the station sick quarters.
Did you fall sick yourself whilst you were at Basra?
I beg your pardon?
Did you fall sick yourself whilst you were at Basra?
I did, but we'll come to that a little later on. In the first year, I was perfectly happy. And in fact, during the first summer, after I moved to the flight line, I was for a few months there helping with servicing the aircraft. And then at that time, Mussolini was beginning to create a stir in the Middle East. And our squadron was prepared to move to Aden. The flying crews, they went off. When did we go? We went in August. At the end of August, they moved to Aden. And the rest of us, who were ground crew, the flying boat crew, the tradesmen, we went on by ship. The ship was the one of the ordinary BI line, which traded between Basra and Bombay, and we were carried as deck cargo. There were no bunks or anything for us. There were about 40 of us, and we had 2 3-ton lorries which were loaded up with all the flying boat spares and other bits of equipment that were needed. And we took our own kit. We had bed rolls, and we just bedded down on the deck on this BI boat. There were also native families travelling. They had their sheep with them. They were also on the rear end of this boat, and we set off down at the right, calling it all the little places down the Persian Gulf. I had no priority whatsoever, and it was a long, tedious trip. One of the boys developed malaria, and we had no doctor with us, but we did have a medical orderly, and he dosed this chappie with malaria, with quinine, and made a bed in the back of one of these lorries. And so we went on down, and we went to Bombay. Now, when we reached Bombay, we saw this big white liner there, which was the SS Strathaird. And we found that it was should have sailed, but it was waiting for us. And we got off this BI boat, and we went along and boarded this Strathaird. And there were lots and lots and lots of ladies everywhere, and we were all cheering us madly as we came on. And we found out that these were wives of civil servants in India who'd were being sent home by their husbands because they thought, which we didn't know anything about, but they thought that there was going to be a war. You see, so we were heroes who were going to war, and they really gave us a good time. We had as soon as we got on board, the ship sailed, and we were dirty, of course, having spent 7 days lying on the deck of this boat going down. In the heat on the Persian Gulf, and they took our uniforms and washed them and ironed them and pressed them beautifully, and we went and made ourselves clean and settled down, and we had 4 lovely days going across to Aden, entertainment all the way, and we were made to feel thoroughly at home, and that this was just it. They thought we were heroes going to war. And they were being sent home, you see.
Was the feeling then that Britain should have a go at the Italians?
Yes, I suppose it was, because at that time, you see, they were expanding in Mussolini, and we had British Somaliland there, which was in that area, and of course we were also in the Sudan and Egypt, and they didn't know where Mussolini was going to finish, and so it was decided to contain him, and the RAF were moved into the area around, I remember that there was two squadrons brought to Port Sudan, and they've just made a camp in the desert outside of Port Sudan. There was a squadron from England, number 12 squadron, which moved to Aden. Our own squadron moved from Basra to Aden. This 12 squadron came from England to Aden. There was another squadron went to Khartoum to reinforce that squadron. So we were reinforced all around that area, you see. I don't know what happened as far as the army was concerned, but this was the RAF movements. Anyway, we reached Aden after 4 days, and then we went ashore, and we found that when we dropped anchor there, we could see our boats were moored about 3 miles up the coast, and we were soon up there, and they were sort of just settling in then. But I found there was only 4 of our 6 boats there, and when I asked where the other 2 were, I found out that they were been sent back home for replacement, and the Air Ministry had decided to refurbish the squadron with 6 new flying boats. The ones we had previously were Rangoons. These Rangoons were an adaptation of the civil Calcutta flying boat, and they were slow and not really a war plane at all. They were a simple, straightforward adaptation of the only 6 ever built for the RAF, and apart from the military equipment inside the boat and the 3 gun positions which had been put on the Rangoons, they were virtually the same as the Calcutta. They could have been converted back into a civil flying boat without a lot of trouble. But when we reached Aden, there was 2 of them had already gone, and they were being flown to Gibraltar. Now there was a new flying boat squadron had been rapidly formed, number 230. And it was formed from the experimental flying boats which were at Felixstowe and sent to Gibraltar. Well, they were going to take our old Rangoons, and whilst we were being replaced with Singapores. So the first, as I say, the first 2 had already gone when I got to Aden. And then a very fortunate thing happened to me. One of the airframe metal riggers, I keep calling them airframe, but that was a later title that we had. One of the metal riggers, on the next pair of boats that were going to go back, he had an older brother in the RAF, and this older brother was in Egypt, and at that time an older brother could claim his younger brother, to claim him, to have him posted to the same unit. And so this chappy's brother had claimed him, and the authorization had just come through that he could go to his brother's unit in Egypt. And of course he was due to go home with this boat, so he either had to forego his transfer to Egypt or to his brother, or could go home to his with a boat to England to make a break in his tour. So he decided it was more important that he should go to his brother, so he said to me, would I take his place on the boat? So of course I was only too willing to do it, but I had to be accepted by his flight command, by his pilot, and his pilot was the flight commander, who insisted that we did 1 or 2 trips to see that I would fit in, and that I could look after the boat properly, of course. Anyway, that was all right, and so at last I got back onto flying again, and So how long would that be? About 3 weeks after I got to Aden, and I set off to fly back. Now this flight commander, I well remember him, he was a First World War man who was just about finishing his time, a squadron leader, Clift, and he was determined that he was going to have a good trip home. He was going home to retire, and so we took a very leisurely trip up the Persian Gulf. We called it Camaran Island, we called it Port Sudan, we called it Hassa Lagoon, we called it Hurghada, and we called it Alexandria, and various other places, Athens, wait a minute, Alexandria, Crete, Mirabella in Crete, Piraeus Harbour in Athens, Corfu, Malta, Bizerta, Algiers, Gibraltar, Lisbon, Hotin in France, eventually back to Plymouth. A trip which took us 3 weeks and about 90 flying hours altogether. It was a really nice trip and everyone thoroughly enjoyed it. Going up the Red Sea, of course, as also around the Persian Gulf, refueling was something of a problem. The fuel was in 4 gallon drums which had been buried in the sand in big mounds of sand and marked on their charts, and if we called it one of these points of refuel, then we had to mount my anchor, which we carried on board, and drop the anchor, get the rubber dinghy out and pump it up by hand. This is one of these balloon type rubber dinghies, and then we would row it ashore trailing a line, and then when we got ashore we would go to one of these mounds. I remember this squadron leader Clifton in one place, he said, make for that tamarisk, you know, which is a small tree, one of the trees that grow out there. And there was a mound, so we'd dig out these drums, take them down to the water edge, tie them to the rope, and then they would float them out through the boat and pull them on board. We would open the tins and pour them through chamois leather into a big drum. Had a big drum, a refueling 20-gallon drum.
Why through chamois leather?
Well, there may be water in it. You see, the chamois leather wouldn't allow the water to go through, and then pump them. It would have to be pumped by hand again, out of this drum, through a Zwicky pump, which was a two-handed pump, which wouldn't have two of us on it, one each side.
What was the name of the pump?
A Zwicky pump, and it had a long handle with two hand grips, one man each side, and we would backwards and forward and backwards and forward, and pump the fuel into the petrol tanks, two of which were in the top wing and two in the bottom wing.
How do you spell Zwicky?
Z W I C K Y. And this was a long-winded operation, you know, and used to take quite a while. I can remember there that one evening I had a long trip, and I think it was one on the trip, this particular trip to Hassa Lagoon, I believe, and when we landed, had a broken flying wire which I had to splice a new cable for. There was a broken fitting on one of the rudders, so I had to make a new fitting, and then helping with this refueling. And of course it was getting dark before we refueled, and on the trip I was also the cook. The airframe man was usually the cook, because the engine fitter had three engines on the Rangoon, or four engines on the Singapore. Took longer to service than the airframe. So the airframe man was the cook. as well. And I know on this one occasion, several occasions, in fact, that I've been below with primer stoves cooking, and there'd been fuel sloshing around on the deck above me. By today's standards, would be a bit dangerous, I suppose, but this is the way we lived, and we're all quite happy. And another occasion I remember on this trip home, we were talking earlier about the might of the British Empire in those days. When we landed at Piraeus in Athens, the Greek Air Force came out to escort us and to take us for an evening's entertainment in town. And they'd ordered a meal in a Britannia restaurant for all of us, officers and airmen. And as we walked in this restaurant, every customer in the place stood up and the band played Rule Britannia. Yeah. Do you think the Greeks would do that today? I don't think so. That was a place where, little did I know it then, but in a few years to come, my own cousin landed during the Second World War, landed at Athens, and came off the ship, and there was a Germans waiting for them there, and taken straight into custody, and never fired a shot in anger. That was his war. But anyway, this was pre-war days, and the British Empire was still at its best.
How did the new flying boats, the Singapores, compare with the Rangoons?
Oh, they were much better. If I may just finish this trip home, we delivered these boats to Gibraltar and spent 2 weeks there while the new crew taking over assimilated them, and we had to collect a Stranraer, which was one of the experimental boats were there, a very nice flying boat which the RAF never took to, but the Canadian Air Force bought them, and in fact there's a very nice example in the RAF Museum at the moment. But so we flew the Stranraer back to Felixstowe, and then we went to the Short Brothers factory at Rochester to collect our own machine being built, the Singapore. And we collected these things one by one. This is why we're going home in pairs. And took it back to Felixstowe and put the radio and equipment in it and accepted it for Royal Air Force service, you know. They're a much better, sturdily built craft altogether. Had four engines, two pushers and two pullers, and they were equipped for individual service, i.e. service, self-maintaining service. You could be leave base altogether and for weeks at a time, and all you needed was fuel and food. You're self-contained, had your own bunks and beddings and you carried spares of all sorts on board. We carried two spare propellers, one pusher and one puller, and much bigger, sturdier craft altogether, this was.
Could you be comfortable sleeping on the Singapore?
Oh yes, yes. We there were bunks inside. There was a ward room at the front for the two officers. One was a pilot and the other was a pilot navigator, and they were their compartment was divided from the rest of the crew. We had curtains which we drew across, and then there were two bunks which were permanently down, which contained all the bedding, and then two bunks which were collapsible ones, which went above, so that you could sleep four crew in the back.